Welcome to the podcast of Grace Covenant Church, where we are transformed by God's grace, connected through relationships, and committed to service.
Today we're going to talk about something very, this is an interesting Sunday every year. This week after school starts, the first or so week of school, that we kind of change the way we teach at Grace and kind of change the focus of things a little bit because we try to take advantage of an opportunity that we have. A lot of people are visiting a church or coming back from all their summer things. And this is the Sunday where we just say, okay, let's look at the fall. Let's look at what we're going to do for the next 4 months or so. And we're going to look at the life of Jesus Christ, mostly from the book of John. And this Sunday, I wanted us to kind of stop and without opening, you know, our Bible so much into John, I want us to stop and ask ourselves, are we in the right place with the right attitude right now? Because, you know, what we do from here on out is kind of, a lot of it's going to be based on what we do today. This is a big Sunday for everybody that's attending Grace Covenant Church. And just to kind of introduce the idea that I'm going to be talking to you about today, I'm going to show you a video that you're probably all familiar with. And I want you to look at it a little more analytically. Because in this video, in 74 seconds, the lead player, the main character of this clip, is going to alter the trajectory of the history of his country. And he's going to do that by changing the minds and the wills of the participants. And he'll do that, listen carefully, by focusing on like a tense, like grammar tense, past, present, future. We'll just use those three. I want you to cite what tense we're talking about and also what emotion, and happy, sad, whatever it might be. And in just a few words, men will alter the way they live and the fate of their country as he appeals to two senses and two emotions. Okay? You know what to look for now? Let's watch the video clip.
I am William Wallace. And I see a whole army of my countrymen here in defiance of tyranny. You've come to fight as free men. And free men you are. What will you do with that freedom? Will you fight?
Fight against that? No! We will run!
And we will live. Aye. Fight and you may die. Run and you'll live. At least a while. And dying in your beds, many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!
Is it historically accurate rendition of things? I would say that just based on the lack of barbers and dental work, don't you think? Nothing speaks clearer to that. Let's talk about the tenses first of all. William Wallace appeals that the future is more important or greater than the present, right? Many years from now. And then the emotions he's appealing to is that regret is more powerful than fear. So let's just do the equation here. This is why things are altered in this storyline, is because future regret is greater than present fear. Let's all say that together. Future regret is greater than present fear. Let's do that one more time, a little louder, please. Future regret is greater than present fear. And these men, they listened to him and they apply that to their lives because they stayed and they fought. Yes, stay and you will die. They did. Many people did die. But they died because the alternative was to run and live with regret. A relatively famous but similar clip is from the movie Patton. We couldn't show that because the language is too salty. But George Patton motivated his troops by saying, later on, when you're a grandfather and you're bouncing your grandbaby on your knee, and they said, Grandpa, where were you during the Great War? the Second World War, you won't have to say that you were shoveling manure in Louisiana, but rather that you were marching across Europe in the Third Army following that son of a gun, George S. Patton. Future regret is greater than present fear, and Patton appealed to that, and William Wallace appealed to that, because inside their hearts, these men knew that to be true, and they did not want to live a long life with regret. Growing old is not an easy thing to do. It's not a day in the park, because every single phase of life brings to you opportunities to be afraid and sorrowful. It's kind of like it's in the calendar. And if you're kind of getting to a point where you're confident in your life stage right now, it's because you're in transition into the next one. You have more things coming. And it only gets harder, not because of the wear and tear on your body, that's hard enough as it is, but it's what happens to your soul over the years as you can acquire carnage from the previous season. And if you don't deal with it, if you run and live and don't stay and fight, you bring that with you, and it just adds to your new phase of life. And that's why when Norman Furley was reading from Psalm 90, Moses talks about the wickedness of the world, kind of the wrath of God, just in our circumstances in a fallen world. And he culminates that writing by saying, teach us to number our days aright that we might gain a heart of wisdom. Teach us to number the days of our lives so that you would give us a heart of wisdom. What does that prayer of Moses mean? What kind of wisdom do we gain if we realize that we only live, like it says in the previous verses, 70 years, maybe 80? Mark Twain said in his autobiography, a very interesting thing, he said, life would be infinitely better if we were born at 80 years old and then slowly moved towards 18. Oh yeah. It would be much better because you would have the wisdom and the purity of vision, 20/20 hindsight, as you made your decisions, and you could see the consequences as they played themselves out, you know, in your past, which would be, you know, in your life when you're 80. I mean, wouldn't that be a fabulous thing to gain a heart of wisdom by thinking at 80 and then playing it back? Well, that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about kind of the seasons of life. It says in Psalms, David writes that there's seven phases of life. Shakespeare talks of seven phases, probably taking that out of Psalms. There's a number of psychologists that have written, I think, eight. Some Eric Erickson writes about eight phases. There's a t-shirt that says there are four phases of life. You don't believe in Santa Claus. You do believe in Santa Claus. You don't believe in Santa Claus. You are Santa Claus. Now you look like Santa Claus. Yeah, okay. Well, here's what I want us to do. I'm just going to survey, you know, about five of these, using these three chairs to help kind of understand that thing. But I want you to stop, and I want to ask you this question before we move on. What is your current fear? The phase of life that you're in right now, what are you afraid of? Because it's easy to think that you can run and live, but you live with regret. It's better, not easier, but it's better to stand and fight. Because if you choose to run, then there'll be a day when in your future where you're going to wish and trade in every day from that day until this day that you would have stayed right now and fought that thing. What are you afraid of right now? Not circumstantially. I mean emotionally, down to your soul and even to your spirit. You know, your view of God. What are you afraid of? Now, with that in mind, let's just kind of look at our little props here. The first chair faces the future. It's going this way. It's the foundational years. If you can just imagine your life as building a house, it kind of helps put a picture in your mind. And the first part is the foundational years. It's focusing on the forward. I'm 2.5 years old. I'm going on 3. Right? They're looking into the future. They're always wanting to be older. And from 0 to 10 or so, you're dealing with things like understanding that you're different, then you're not attached to your mother anymore. You get an identity. You learn how to take initiative. You know, I want to do things. I want to do it, Mom. That's the three-year-olds or two-year-olds. And then there's supposed to be a conscience built in those early years as well. Some sort of industry. Some people call that industry. The ability to understand what you're good at. And then at the end of this turmoil, after 10, 11 to 18, it hits adolescence. You're not quite an adult yet. And the thing you have to work on then is solidifying your personal identity independent of your parents. There's a big fancy word called individuation. It's a very important phase of a person's life as they separate from their mother or their father and they say, I am this person. And the other thing they have to deal with is who their peer group will be. And that's the current fear that they're in. And loneliness is the tuition you pay for good friendships in adolescence. Because once you define yourself, you're looking for other people that will help kind of add kind of an elixir to that to solidify that identity. And if you pick the peer group poorly, if you're more afraid than you are courageous, if you want to run and hide and grab, you know, run and you will live, and you'll take any peer group that will take you in, then you'll live with regret, a lot of regret. So it's better to stay, and you may die, stay in your loneliness and hold out for people that will bring you circumstances and language that will make you the way God wants to make you. So that's the foundational years up to about 18 or so. And then in this chair, this is where we start taking responsibility for our lives. This is 18 to 35 or so. It's called early adulthood. And this is the first floor of the house that we're building. It's just the insides of that first floor. And now we're starting to make choices that we are more informed and maybe understand what the consequences will be and we need to make them. Now, the single issue that you have to focus on here has to do with intimacy. It's during these times that we learn how to engage deeply with other human beings. Because the alternative to intimacy is isolation. We kind of turn into ourselves where it's safe. We run and we live with regret. But if we pursue the things that are good, and I'm talking about honest, deep, transparent relationships that go back and forth. Okay, you're able to give and receive love. You're able to give and receive affection. You can have truth-filled conversations. Now, one of the problems with this season of life, the 18 to 35 or so, is that you're generally fairly insecure. You're bringing that from the previous season of life, and you're usually pretty competitive. You're trying to keep up or pass that same peer group that you're trying to befriend. And if you don't stop and fight those insecurities and that edge, then you won't be able to develop good relationships. You'll turn inwards towards isolation because you'll say somewhere in kind of the experience of having friends and a mate, you'll say, I don't need this. This hurts too much. I put myself out there. I said something I've never told anyone else, and this is what I got back. And so you just turn in and you become stagnant. And you say to yourself, I'll be safe here. Yeah, you'll run and you'll live, but you won't want that life later on. Patty Griffin writes a very deep and sorrowful song about a man writing his wife, and he's about maybe, let's say, 75, 80 years old. He's done. He can't make any more choices of consequence anymore. And he regrets every aspect of their marriage because she was like this, it's called On Top of the World, and she's like this little songbird to him, and he broke her wings because of being isolated. And there's this one core or part of one of the verses that it reads this, I wish I'd have known you. This is just nothing. Listen, feel the saturation of regret. I wish I'd have known you. I wish I'd have shown you all the things that I was inside. But I pretended to be sleeping when you came in the morning and you whispered goodbye to go out in the rain. And I don't know why. I don't know why, he says. But somehow I clipped the wings off that little songbird and now she doesn't sing so much anymore. There's another section in that song where he talks about how people called him to dinner and he pretended to be asleep in the recliner. He didn't know why. I'll tell you why. Because he was afraid. He thought his present fears were less than his future regrets. And that wasn't true. And now he sings this song where he wishes he could have come, and wish he would trade every day from that day to this day to open up and try it again and be the husband he's supposed to be. But he didn't. So that's the early adulthood. That's the first kind of level of things. And the second level of things as we move towards the end of our life, this is middle adulthood. This is 36 or so to, about 65. And the issue in this section of life is whether we're going to be givers or takers. Whether we're going to kind of expand ourselves, not just emotionally, but also just kind of invest. The word that some books will use, some authorities will say, is invest versus stagnate. And invest means, it means giving unconditionally without any expectation of thanks to people that are needy and younger. Okay, it's investing into generations that you'll never see the fruit of your labor. It is, if you could picture it, it's you hauling a boat out to the lake, filling it up with gas, dragging a bunch of kids around in it, never expecting to get behind the boat itself, pulling it back up on the trailer, tarping it down, bringing it back. No one says boo to you. No one says thanks. No one gives you the time of day. And you go to bed saying, it was a good day out at the lake. That's a metaphor. It's a simple little picture. But it's expecting nothing, and you're just giving. You have to get to a stage in life, in this what's called late adulthood, or middle adulthood, actually, where you get it. Life isn't about getting. It's about giving. Now, the alternative to that is stagnation, where you're still thinking that it's about you, and you're looking around wondering why other people are passing you up. And you're keeping score that way. But investing is meeting neighbors on the street and saying, you know, I'm going to help this young couple get along, and they're going to move out of my neighborhood. They're going to buy a bigger place later on, and I'm okay with that. I'm happy for them. It's at work, you're doing the same thing. As the younger people start coming up, you realize, boy, they're going to have your job someday. And that's okay. Because you're an investor, you're a giver, not a taker, and you're not threatened by them, you're encouraged by them, and you know they'll have your desk. But that's fine. As opposed to being competitive about that and undermining. The stagnation is just always wanting something else out of life. There's a couple cartoons that are pretty informative about this one. Look at the first one. Look, greener pastures. look at the age of the men in this picture. I've got to go somewhere else to get what I want. Even more telling is this next picture. Why there's never a recession in psychiatry. I want what you've got. City guys moving to the country, country guy moving to the city. But see, look what the key of the whole comic is. I want, I want, I want, I want. And since they never face the fear of conquering their greed and their self-centeredness, that's what they fear. Will I get anything out of life if I'm just a giver? Jesus said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. Do you know why he said that? Anyone? Because it's true. It really is. But if you just take, that's fine, and you'll live, and you'll carry that with you to the next phase. If you choose to be isolated instead of intimate, that's stuff you bring to this next stage, this middle adulthood. And if you're isolated, you're probably going to want to be selfish and get all that you can. And if you're going to be that stagnant, then you move into the next stage of life. And this faces back. If that's the foundation and this is the first and second floor of your building, then this is the house itself that you live in from 66 until the day you die. And I think Eric Erickson, again, the psychiatrist that, or psychologist that, both actually, that coined some of the seasons of life. He does a wonderful job using words for describing this chair as they look back. It's, listen to this, ego integrity or despair. Isn't that vivid? I mean, there's two postures, right? There's two postures. Ego integrity is like this, with your hands open, kind of looking back at your life with little to no regret because you chose to stay and to fight. And you became intimate, even though it was a fearful thing, and then you became investing, even though it was very expensive and costly. And now you're not judgmental. You're tolerant towards other people. You can't wait to spend time with people. Your lap is usually full with somebody else's child. You're a delight to be around. You're like this. The other posture is despair. Because the most difficult part of this chair and this description is the fact that there's nothing you can do about it. That future regret is more powerful than present pain, and you kept choosing the wrong thing. You kept running that you would live. And now what happens to the soul is it becomes embittered. It counts what you don't have, not what you do have. You become that grumpy old man, the bitter old woman, the one that people talk about on the way to your house. Now listen, we're going to spend as little time as possible with Grandma. You know how she is. We can't take Dad to a restaurant because he'll make some sort of, you know, judgmental comment about people in the room. And again, you find this house that you've built, it's getting smaller and smaller, and the windows are covered. And you know what happens with people when they get here? They realize that they would trade every day from this day until this day to get back here and have the courage to stay and fight the fear that they're having to deal with. Because future regret is greater than present pain. And unfortunately, most people don't know that. Most people don't know that until it's too late. And that's why Moses says, you know, teach us to number our days and give us a heart of wisdom. Let's just have the goggles of an 80-year-old looking back, that we might have some kind of greater wisdom about how to make these choices, how to face these fears, how to deal with our stuff. So what are we to do about that? Especially as you get farther down this, how do you combat deep-seated issues in your life? And you start seeing the kind of the generational effect of being a smothering mother or an angry father, a controlling individual towards other people. And you're starting to see already as you move down this kind of one-way street, what can you do about it? The thing is, you've got to find something that is more powerful. We sang about that, didn't we? Something more powerful than the undertow of the fears and the foundational issues that you were that were brought into your life and that you chose to add to your life. But what could be stronger than your stubbornness? Your unwillingness to want to change. And the deep-seated issues that are sometimes down in here deeper than you can even explore, or you're afraid to explore because of maybe some shame that's involved in that. I would say before we look at that answer, I want to ask this question. Do you want to change? Do you really want to get better? Do you want to stand and fight? And yes, you will be hurt. Oh gosh. Oh yes, you will suffer. But the alternative is to live long and not prosper, but to just live with a lot of regret, where you would change and turn in every day from that day of old age to this day to get things right, to fight the battles that we're proposing today. Every phase of life gets them. So I think before we even go any further, I feel like we have to deal with that single biggest issue is, do you want to change? Are you willing to pay? Are you willing to work? Are you willing to let God do something in your life? Something that is bigger than stubbornness or panic or arrogance that's wrecking relationships around you, or even perfectionism that ruins your life and every life that you touch? Is there something stronger and bigger than that? Yes, there is. It's found in Jesus Christ and His Spirit. And the reason that people don't change is twofold. One is they don't know that there's a power that's bigger than their injuries or their fears. And the second thing is they might know there's a power, but they don't know how to use it or choose not to. And that's why people can go to church for, decades and not really alter their flight against every fear they come across. I heard a guy this week say, in his estimation, 85% of Christians do not experience the life that God promised, an abundant life, because they will not face the fears before them. They run, and they live with regret. So listen, I'm going to do just part one right now. But part one, remember, there's two parts why people don't change. One is they don't know there's a power available to them. And the other one is they don't know how to use that power. We're going to spend the whole semester talking about the power of Jesus Christ and how to actually use God's Spirit to alter our intellect, the way we think, our emotions, and the choices that we make. Okay, so we'll spend 4 months on that when we go through the book of John. Today, I want to take advantage of this opportunity to say, how do you initiate? What if you don't know about it? How do you initiate that? Well, I would say this. The Bible, from cover to cover, is trying to explain to us that our rebellion against God cuts us off from God. Our relationship with God is bifurcated, is cut in half because of our rebellion against Him. Now, rebellion, it's a loaded term, but don't think it's just shaking your fist at God. We have those moments, certainly. But most of us, our rebellion is just kind of folding our arms. And whatever, you know? And not acting as though He's the creator and the maker of all things. And so we end up worshiping things He creates instead of the creator Himself. Well, that rebellion, it's a quick, easy word, sin, has a consequence. It has a price tag attached to it. And the price tag is significant. The Bible itself says, you can see it in the Old Testament and you see it in the New Testament, that the cost of sin is death. That when you rebel against God, whether it's with a fist or folded arms, that it's going to cost you life and death. Now, we have an intuitive understanding of that. Aristotle wrote about it. We know that to be true. What do we do about it? Every religion in the world, save one, every religion in the world except one says, try to earn His favor. You come to church. Yeah, okay. That counts as a good mark. Uh-huh. And then help other people. Good. Good for you. Okay. The Bible says that's not how it works because I don't think you understand the cost. The cost is death. And see, that's why Good Friday makes sense. Or if you saw the movie, The Passion of the Christ, if you just saw the poster of The Passion of the Christ, you'd have to wonder what in the world is happening here. Well, what's happening here is Jesus Christ is paying the price for rebellion. And listen, He didn't get beaten one too many times or one too few times. When you see that beating, that's what it costs to pay your bill. And the more you get to know God, the more you understand that to be true. When you see the movie, you think, my sins aren't that bad. Then you get closer and closer to God and you say, oh, wow. It's no wonder He had to get back up in the middle of that beating. Jesus, that was. So, watch this. All the world religions over here, try harder. Christianity says, by God's love and favor, His mercy, He's giving you the payment Jesus made. Look at these two verses in Titus. Summarizes and contrasts Christianity to everything else. Look at this. Titus 3, 4, and 5. But in the kindness and the love of God, that's what's motivating Him. In the kindness and the love of God, our Savior appeared. That's Jesus. He saved us, not because of the righteous things we had done, but because of His mercy. Not because of the righteous things, not because of church attendance, not because of all that great stuff you're doing. Good for you. That doesn't count towards your bill. Doesn't even pay the interest. He saved us because of his kindness and his love. It's the mercy that covers us and makes us right. How do you get in on the power that can transform you and face these fears and help you conquer them? You have to give up this model of religious practices, and Jesus speaks against this a lot, we'll see. And you have to come over to this side and you say, I'm just going to receive this as a gift. Have you ever done that? Have you ever had your eyes open and say, wait a minute, okay, I get it now. I just take this as a gift, this payment, somebody else writing a check to God, and now I'm clear with him. That's all you do. Yeah, that's what faith is. It's believing that that was more than enough to pay for your debt. Well, you could do that today. Why don't you think about doing that today? Think about saying, I'm not going to be a doer of Christian activity. I'm going to be a receiver of Jesus Christ and his Spirit. Do that today. And here's the thing. If we kind of go through this together, this next 4 months together, I think we'll be glad we did. And if you don't, you're going to regret it. I have like two homework assignments for you, okay? They're kind of easy, really hard to do, though. They're simple. It's not easy. The first one is this. I want you to write your own obituary. It's a great thing to do. It's a healthy thing to do. I want you to write your own obituary. I want you to sit in this chair as though you die on Saturday. I'll give you 6 days to live, okay? And you're sitting in this chair 6 days from now, and I want you to write what's true about your life. And then I want you to write a second obituary. I want you to be sitting in this chair at 78 years old, and I want you to write what might be true about your life. That's part one, write an obituary. The second assignment I have for you is that I want you to very seriously consider all in. All in. That's what we're asking today, is that you go all in. And this semester, as we go through this stuff together, when we look at the life of Jesus Christ, we're starting a thing called the Voyage. We do this at Grace. Every 2 years, we read through the Bible. Well, if you go to our Welcome Center or go to our website, we can send you a Bible passage a day, and in 2 years, you'll read through the Bible. We're going to read through the New Testament in these next 9 months, and then we're going to read through the Old Testament in 2012, 2013. You can get a bookmark. I want you, and when, here's the point, is when you open your Bible, you go through this adventure with us, when before you start reading, you say these words and you mean them. You say, all in. I'm all in. When you come in this congregation, when you come in here, that's the other part of all in, is coming in here for the next 4 months, studying the life of Jesus Christ together, and when you sit down, you say, I'm all in. I think everything I've been doing, I've been playing games. I've been hedging my bet. I'm not, you know, that guy really believes it. I'm going to really believe it. Because listen, if we just did this for 4 months together, if we just went all in our Bible reading, in our church participation, in our relationships, we're going to live a life right here that matters and that faces the enemy, the demons that haunt us, the phases of life that cause us fear. And if we don't, I'm telling you, you're going to sit in this chair someday in your life and you're going to say, I will trade every day from this day until this day, August 28th, 2011. I would trade all those days to come back on this Sunday and say, I should have gone all in. And I don't know why I didn't. I should have gone all in. So friends, do that. Do that today. Just join me in a prayer that says, I want to be 100% this time. And I'll do whatever has to be done, okay?
For more information about Grace, visit our website at grace360.org.